often discussed the matter with his wife. The board will send them to New England, then to Yale. But the important thing is that they never come into contact with Hawaiians. Dr. Whipple watched the Hewletts cross the deck and go down the hatchway aft. And the manner in which the Hawaiian woman watched over little Abner Hewlett proved that whereas she might have crept into the father's bed by some trick or other, she certainly loved the child. "Boy's lucky," Whipple said. "He's got a good mother." "She doesn't look the way I expected," Abner confessed. "You expected a painted whore?" Whipple laughed. "Abner, once in a while you ought to look at the reality of life." "How did she become a Christian?" Abner pondered. "Abraham Hewlett took her into the church," Whipple explained. There was a thoughtful pause, and then Abner asked, "But how could they have been married? I mean, if Hewlett was the only minister, who could have married them?" "For the first year, nobody did."
"You mean they lived in sin?"
"And then I came along on one of my regular trips. I was in a Russian ship."
"And you married a Christian minister to a heathen?" Abner asked, aghast.
"Yes, I'm probably going to be censured too," Whipple said dryly. "And I have a suspicion in here," and he touched his heart, "that I won't accept the censure. I stand with St. Paul. It is better to marry than to burn." "Can anyone seriously doubt that Abraham is better off today than he was when you left him in Wailuku?" The meeting in Honolulu went as expected. At first, Abraham Hewlett made a sorry spectacle of himself, confessing that in marrying the Hawaiian girl Malia, he had sinned against the decrees of God, thus bringing degradation upon both himself and the church. He begged forgiveness, asking the brethren to remember that he had been left alone with an infant boy, and at the recollection of his misery in those lonely days, he wept. Later, when it was suggested that perhaps the sly Hawaiian woman had been responsible for his downfall, he recovered a portion of his dignity by avowing that he loved this gracious, tender girl, and that it was he who had insisted upon the marriage. And if the brethren think they dare imply censure of Malia, they are indeed mistaken. The vote was an easily predicted condemnation and expulsion, only Whipple and Quigley speaking in defense. The meeting thought it best that the Hewletts leave the islands, for your presence here would be a constant humiliation to the church. But it is recognized that it would be equally disgraceful for a Christian minister, an unfrocked one that is, to return to America with a Hawaiian wife, for there are many in America who are eager to castigate missionaries, and your appearance among them would merely add ammunition to their blasphemies. It is therefore concluded that you and your family ought. At this point, Abraham's tears were dried, and he interrupted bluntly. "It is not within your province to advise me in these matters. I shall live where I wish." "You will receive no sustenance from us," the meeting reminded him. "I have entered into a compact to raise pigs and sugar cane for the whaling ships at Lahaina, and beyond this you are required to know nothing. But before I go, I must point out that your mission is founded upon an impossible contradiction. You love the Hawaiians as potential Christians, but you despise them as people. I am proud to say that I have come to exactly the opposite conclusion, and it is therefore appropriate that I should be expelled from a mission where love is not." Dr. Whipple thought that when the scrawny man with the big eyes finally left the judgment room, he departed with some dignity. The meeting then turned to the doctor's case, and condemned him for having married the pair, thus constituting himself, as one minister pointed out, the agency, if not the cause, whereby our miserable brother from Hana fell into temptation and sin. Dr. Whipple retorted, "I should rather have thought that I was the agency whereby he fell out of sin." This sally, being both witty and cogent,
furthered the case against the doctor, and all the missionaries except Quigley joined in a vote of censure. Whipple was reproved and advised to be more circumspect in the future. To Ebner's surprise, his roommate accepted the condemnation and sat without even a look of resentment as the meeting turned to less weighty matters, including assignments of the mission family to new posts. But when it came time for the Thetis to return to Lahaina, Ebner was surprised to find Dr. Whipple, his wife Amanda, and their two boys ensconced in the stateroom. "I thought you were directed to go to Kauai," Ebner remarked. "Where I am directed to go, and where I go, are two vastly different matters," Whipple said easily. And Ebner was relieved to notice that they had no luggage, so apparently they were on a short visit to one of the Way Islands, Molokai or Lanai. But when these ports were cleared, the Whipple family was still aboard. And at the pier in Lahaina, John grabbed Abner's hand and said, "Don't leave. I want you to witness exactly what happens. There's Jerusha. I'd like to have her come along, too, because I don't want contradictory reports circulated regarding what I am about to do." And with his wife and children in tow, he led the Hales to Captain Jander's store and said boldly, "Captain, I have come to throw myself on your mercy." "What do you mean?" Jander's asked suspiciously. "You're doing a large business here, Captain, and with more whalers coming each year, you'll need a partner. I want to be that partner." "You leaving the mission?" "Yes, sir." "Over the Hewlett affair?" "Yes, sir, and others. I happen to believe that men who work should get a just salary." He tugged at his ill-fitting trousers, pointed at Amanda's dress, and said, "I'm tired of going down to the mission grab bag in Honolulu to see what scraps the good people in Boston have sent us this year. I want to work for myself, get my own wage, and buy my own things." "Does Amanda feel the same?" Captain Janders asked. "She does." "Do you, Amanda?" "I love the Lord. I love to serve the Lord. But I also love an organized home, and in these matters I am with my husband." "You got any money to put into the venture?" Janders asked warily. "My family comes to you with absolutely nothing," the handsome, dark-haired doctor, then 29, replied. "We have these clothes, picked from the rag bag, and that is all. I have no medicine, no tools, no luggage. Certainly I have no money. But I have a knowledge of these islands that no other man on earth has, and that's what I offer you." "Do you speak the tongue?" "Perfectly." Janders thought a moment, then stuck out his rugged hand. "Son, you're my partner. On the Thetis, when you ask so many questions, I remarked you." "I have only one request, Captain," Whipple said. "I want to borrow enough money, right now. We'll fix you up with clothes and a place to live. Enough money to buy my own medical outfit, and anyone who wants medical advice from me can get it free. For I am a servant of the Lord, but I am determined to serve him in my way and not some other." By the end of the week, the Whipples had moved into a small grass shack, which Kalolo gave them along with a substantial square of land in return for medical care for Malama, whose exertions on behalf of the new laws had taxed her strength. And at the start of the next week, the first of many signboards that were to become famous throughout Hawaii appeared on the dusty main streets of Lahaina. Janders and Whipple. Ebner's disturbing experiences in Honolulu, where both Abraham Hewlett and John Whipple had challenged the missionary board, confirmed his natural suspicion that there was inherent danger from too close relationships with the Hawaiian savages. And it was under the impetus of this fear that he built a high wall around his entire establishment, leaving an extra gate at the rear through which Jerusha could exit to her girls' classes, held in an open shed under the kou trees. Within the wall, not a word of Hawaiian was spoken. No Hawaiian maid was allowed to enter unless she knew English. And if a deputation of villagers came to see Abner, He would carefully close the door leading to where his children were, and he would take the Hawaiians to what he called the native room, where their voices could not be heard by the little ones. "We must not learn the ways of the heathen," Abner constantly warned his family. For what Abraham Hewlett had suggested in Honolulu regarding all missionaries was particularly true of Abner. He loved the Hawaiians, yet he despised them. He was, therefore, not in very good humor when Kalolo came to visit him one night, which forced him to close off the children's room, lest they hear Hawaiian being spoken. "What is it you want?" he asked testily. "In church the other day," Kalolo said in Hawaiian, "I listened to Keoki read that beautiful passage from the Bible in which this man begat that man, and the other man begat another man." The big chief's face was radiant with pleasant memory of the biblical message which Hawaiians loved above all other. The begats, they called it among themselves. Abner had long been curious about this partiality for the chapter in Chronicles, for he felt sure the Hawaiians could not understand it. "Why do you like that passage so much?" he probed. Kalolo was embarrassed and looked about to see if anyone was listening. Then he confessed somewhat sheepishly, "There is much in the Bible we do not understand. How could we? We don't know the many things the white man knows. But when we hear the begats, it is like music to our ears, Makuahale, because it sounds just like our own family histories, and for once we can feel as if we too were part of the Bible." "What do you mean, family histories?" Abner asked. "That is what I came to see you about. I see you at work translating the Bible into my language, and we appreciate your hard work. Malama and I were wondering if, before she dies, no, Makuahale, she is not well, we wondered if you would write down for us in English our family history. We are brother and sister, you know." "I know," Abner mumbled. "I am the last one who knows the family history," Kalolo said. "When Keoke should have been learning it, he was learning about God. Now he is too old to memorize the way I did when I was studying to be a kohuna." Abner, a learned man, instantly saw the value of preserving old fables and asked, "How does a family history sound, Kalolo?" "I want you to write it as if Keoke were saying it. I am doing this for him so that he will know who he is." "How does it begin?" Abner pressed. It was dark in the grass house, with only one feeble whale oil lamp swaying with its retinue of shadows, when Kalolo, seated cross-legged on the floor, began, "I am Keoki, the son of Kalolo, who came to Maui with Kamehameha the Great, who is the son of Kanakoa, the king of Kona, who was the son of Kanakoa, the king of Kona, who sailed to Kauai, who was the son of Kalolo, the king of Kona, who died in the volcano, who was the son of Kalolo, the king of Kona, who stole Kekela'ali'i from Oahu, who was the son of..." After Abner had listened for a while, his curiosity as a scholar overcame his initial boredom at this tedious and probably imaginary ritual. "How did you memorize this genealogy?" he asked. "An ali'i who doesn't know his ancestry has no hope of position in Hawaii," Kalolo explained. "I spent 3 years memorizing every branch of my family. The kings of Kona are descended, you know, from the..." "Are these genealogies real or made up?" Abner asked bluntly. Kalolo was amazed at the question. "Made up, Makuahale. It is by these that we live. Why do you suppose Malama is the Ali'i Nui? Because she can trace her ancestry far back to the second canoe that brought our family to Hawaii. Her ancestor was the high priestess Malama, who came in that second canoe. My name goes back to the first canoe from Bora Bora, for my ancestor was the high priest of that canoe, Kalolo." Abner suppressed a smile as the illiterate chief before him tried to establish relations with some mythical event that must have occurred 10 centuries before, if at all. He thought of his own family in Marlborough. His mother knew when her ancestors reached Boston, but no one could recall when the Hales had got there, and here was a man who could not even write, claiming, "You say you can remember the canoes in which your people came?" "Of course. It was the same canoe on each trip." "How can you remember that?" Abner demanded sharply. "Our family has always known its name. It was the canoe Wait for the West Wind. It had Kilolo as navigator, Kanakoa as king, Pa at one paddle and Malo at the other. Kupuna was the astronomer, and Kilolo's wife Kelani was aboard. The canoe was 80 feet long by your measures, and the voyage took 30 days. We have always known these things about the canoe."
"You mean a little canoe like that one at the pier? How many people did you mention?
7? 8? In a canoe like that?" Abner was contemptuous of the man. "It was a double canoe, Makuahale, and it carried not 8 people, but 58.
Abner was dumbfounded, but once more his historical sense was excited, and he wished to know more about the myths of these strange people.
"Where did the canoe come from?" he asked.
"From Bora Bora," Kilolo said.
"Oh yes, you mentioned that name before. Where is it?"
"Near Tahiti," Kilolo said simply.
"Your people came in a canoe from Tahiti?"
Abner dropped the question and said, "I suppose the family history ends there."
"Oh, no," Kilolo said proudly. "That is not even the halfway mark."
This was too much for Abner, and he stopped abruptly calling it a family history. He realized that he had got hold of one of the classic myths of the Hawaiian Islands, and he said bluntly, "I'll copy it down for you, Kilolo. I would like to hear the story." He adjusted the swinging lamp, took fresh sheets of paper, and laid aside for some nights his Bible translation. "Now tell me very slowly," he said, "and don't leave out anything." In the darkness, Kilolo began to chant. "The time of the birth of the Tabu chief, the time when the Bold One first saw light. At first dimly like the rising of the moon in the season of the little eyes in the ancient past. The great god Kane went into the goddess Waioli-Oli, and the offspring of light were born, the bringers of men. Akaiki, who dragged the islands from the sea, and gentle La'ila'i, who made the flowers and the birds. And in the evening of the long day, Akaiki knew his sister, and the man was born, bringer of honor and war." And as Kilolo chanted the historic summary of his people, the little room was filled with the clash of battle, the birth of gods, the abduction of beautiful women, and the explosions of ancient volcanoes. Men in yellow capes, carrying spears, marched from one lava flow to another. Queens fought for their children's rights, and brave men perished in storms. In time, Abner fell under the spell of the fabulous events, these made-up memories of a race. And when Kilolo and Malama and the canoe Wait for the West Wind made their second journey from Bora Bora to Hawaii, the little missionary caught a momentary thrill of the vast ocean and its perils, as Kilolo, sitting in the darkness, chanted what purported to be the song of directions for that imaginary voyage. "Wait for the west wind. Wait for the west wind. Then sail to Nukuhiva of the dark bays to find the constant star. Hold to it. Hold to it, though the eyes grow dim with heat." But whenever Abner found his mind prepared to accept some small aspect of the narrative as true, ridiculous legendary events intruded, like Kilolo's account of how his ancestor in Bora Bora left for the trip north at the height of a hurricane, with waves 40 feet high. "Imagine a Hawaiian canoe even venturing out of port in a strong wind," Abner laughed to Jerusha as he recounted some of the more fantastic passages in the history. "Just look. Right here, we have more than 40 generations of supposedly historic characters. Now, if you allot 20 years to each generation, and that's conservative, Kilolo wants us to believe that his ancestors came here more than 800 years ago,
and then went back to get a second canoe load. Impossible.
When Kilolo finished his genealogy, 128 generations in all, Ebner prudently made a copy of what he termed this primitive and imaginary poem and sent it to Yale College, where it formed the basis for most accounts of Hawaiian mythology. Scholars appreciated in particular the detailed descriptions of the conflict between the Bora Bora god Kani and the Hawaiki god Koro. Ebner himself had slight regard for his work, and when he summoned Keoki to present the original, he said condescendingly, "Your father claims it's a family history."
"It is," Keoki bristled.
"Now, Keoki, more than 125 generations, nobody can remember."
"Kahunas can," Keoki said stubbornly.
"You sound as if you were defending the kahunas," Ebner suggested.
"In the recitation of family histories, I am," Keoki replied.
"But this is ridiculous. Mythology, fantasy." Ebner slapped the manuscript with disdain.
"It is our book," Keoki said, clutching it to his bosom.
"The Bible is your book, and these memories are our book."
"How dare you, a man who presumes to ask when he will be made a minister?"
"Why is it, Reverend Hale, that we must always laugh at our book, but always revere yours?"
"Because my book, as you improperly call it, is the divine word of God, while yours is a bundle of myths."
"Are the Bagats any more true than the memories of the kahunas?" Keoki challenged.
"True?" Ebner gasped, his temper rising with his astonishment.
"One is the divinely revealed word of the Lord. The other..."
He paused in contempt and ended,
"Good heavens, do you consider them equal?"
"I think there is much in the Old Testament that is merely the work of kahunas, nothing more," Keoki said firmly.
Then, to repay Ebner for his arrogance, he asked in confidence,
"Tell me, Reverend Hale, don't you honestly think that Ezekiel was mostly kahuna?"
"You had better go," Ebner snapped icily. But he felt some shame for having goaded the boy, so he put his arm about his shoulder and pointed.